Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Plenty to come on the show today, and you can text us, the number is 51551, or email todaycb@rte.ie. I'm joined in the studio by the Taoiseach Leo Varadkar. You're very welcome. Thank you for being here this morning. I want to start with the protests in County Clare this week. You have said that the blockade down there at either end of the road is wrong, that government would stand up to racist and extreme views. But are you directing your own party TDs to convey that message to their constituents on the ground?
Well, you know, just to be clear, my reference towards violence and racism was in relation to the attack that happened here in Dublin on Sandwich Street. I'm not accusing and wouldn't accuse the people in Inchin Clare of that.
And I didn't suggest that.
Of a different nature. Essentially, what we're saying, saying is two things. Yes, of course, we have to take the concerns of local communities seriously. They're entitled to information, communication, consultation, all that is underway. But no community has a right to veto other people moving into their community. And that's something we can't accept. Mm-hmm. My colleague in Clare, Senator Martin Conway, has already said that he believes that the blockade should end. And I agree with that. The blockade should end.
But do you understand that local representatives are trying to strike this balance here? They're trying to listen to their constituents and represent them, but also follow the party line. And what instruction do you give them in that regard?
Well, I suppose we don't really give instructions in that kind of scenario. I heard, you know, Senator Timmy Dooley on the radio this morning. Mm-hmm. I thought he was very measured and very balanced in what he said. You know, what he said is he didn't want to say anything that might escalate the situation. So these things have to be dealt with sensitively. We shouldn't miss out on the bigger picture here. In the past year, roughly 100,000 people have come to Ireland seeking protection, most of them from Ukraine, fleeing the war in Ukraine. But, you know, over 10,000 from other parts of the world seeking protection for different reasons. Almost all of those have been accommodated. 14,000 in school, 15,000 working, lot very well integrated into our society, broadly welcomed by communities all over the country. But, you know, we are struggling because there is a shortage of accommodation and a lot of the accommodation that we're now providing isn't ideal, but it's much better than having people in tents or on the streets.
So which is still happening.
In a crisis, the perfect is the enemy of the good. And that's what I would just say to people, whether it's in Clare, whether it's in Dunleary, whether it's in Santry. This is a crisis, and in a crisis, the perfect is the enemy of the good, and we need to do the best we can by people. And the basic thing you provide for any human being, whatever your views are on immigration or asylum, the basic things you have to provide for any human being is shelter and access to basic healthcare.
I was just interested to see what you said on this yesterday. You understand people's concerns, but that does not mean anyone can say that certain types of people cannot live in their area. Now, what certain types of people do you believe locals in County Clare are objecting to? What does that mean? What do you think is behind this?
Fair question. Happy to answer that. That isn't just in relation to the issue of migration, that's also into the issue, wider issue of housing. And we see huge numbers of people, including politicians, objecting to housing in their area. And sometimes it's because there's too many one beds, you know, which I find extraordinary, you know, because if you look at the housing crisis, it's single people who find it hardest
to buy. But you made
that
comment particularly in reference to this situation in County Clare.
Certain
people means what? What are they objecting to?
It can mean different things. It can mean people from outside of Europe. And almost all of these people are from outside of Europe going into that particular centre. And also the idea that single men somehow should not be accommodated. And whether people like it or not, the majority of people who come here from outside of Europe are single men, because that's how migration works. Yeah. And they're the ones who are able to make the journey, and often it's their families follow them later.
And one of your own party councillors, Mary Howard, who's also Deputy Mayor of Clare, she said these are young, single men, they're healthy. If it were 30 to 60 Irish men, people would feel the same. She said one woman was trying to get a landline in so she can get a personal alarm. What do you say to that?
Yeah, I know Mary Howard very well. Spoke to her only last week. Great public rep. I just think we all need to be, including me, by the way, we all need to be sensitive and thoughtful about our comments in relation to migration. And people need to understand migration. Very often it is the single men that are able to make the journey, often travelling long distances. Single men are, and they're not all single, by the way, their families may be back home. Like I know some people, some friends of mine accommodated refugees from Afghanistan. I took somebody in from Ukraine. They took somebody in from Afghanistan, and they were LGBT men, and they made gay men, and they made the journey from Afghanistan, and they had family back home, and they're able to bring the family out after them once they were given asylum. But the assumption made by some people was that these were single men, and they were coming to the country for the wrong reasons, that they may be a threat to women, for example. And nothing could be further from the truth when it came to these men. They actually weren't single. They had family back home, and they certainly weren't a threat to women. But I think these are the kind of tropes that go around. And
that's what it is, a trope. You don't think there's anything genuine in that, that there might be a perceived threat.
I again really want to be sensitive on how I answer that question, and I don't want to, I don't like, you know, domestic violence, gender-based violence, violence against women is very real, and we see from the CSO survey how prevalent that is. But I think ever straying into the space that somehow brown men are more likely to commit those offences than white men, or foreign men are more likely to commit those offences than Irish men. Like, that's not factual, actually.
And that's what
and
you're
we
hearing.
Need to be careful
that's
not
what
to
you're hearing when you hear people say that the very presence of single men en masse in a place like this is a threat, represents a threat to women. That's what you hear.
I'm afraid that that's what I might be hearing. I don't want to accuse people of saying something they didn't say or put words into people's mouth, but I'm aware of that trope. You know, and you know, look, I'm as everyone knows, I'm a gay man, and one of the tropes about gay men is that we're a threat to children, and we're not, and certainly no more than anyone else. And one of the tropes about brown men, quite frankly, is that they're a threat to white women, and I don't like that that kind of talk.
And what role does the government have in counteracting that narrative?
I think disputing it. I think showing leadership, and one thing I'm really encouraged about is the response of our public reps from all parties, government and opposition, in Dunleary, for example, not too far from here. An imperfect solution has been found to accommodate asylum seekers there. Everyone from Jennifer Carol McNeill to Richard Boy Barrett to Cormac Devlin and Oisin Quinn has said this is something we're going to accept in our community and we're going to work with. That's great leadership.
Because Mary Howard said as well, you know, she understands your comment about no community having a veto over who should be there, but she said that you need to visit the site, and she called on Roderick O'Gorman to visit there as well. Now, he has said he won't do that, but they're welcome to come and see him in Dublin. Do you think that that's worthwhile, that that might smooth the path? If yourself or another senior minister went to County Clare to have a look at this place in Inch and try to get a better handle on what the objections are?
Yeah, look, we'll give that consideration. I've been away in Iceland for the past 2 days, haven't had a chance to speak to Minister Gorman or Minister Harris. I will be doing that this evening because they're meeting with the Garda Commissioner on Connected Matters today. So I'll have a chance to touch base with my colleagues this evening. And, you know, we as a government, as ministers, have a responsibility to engage with communities, to take their concerns seriously, to listen to what they have to say. But also we need to be very clear, and I have to say this again, whether it's a local housing development, you know, somebody wanting to build apartments, whether it's accommodation for migrants, whether it's a domestic violence refuge for women who are victims of violence, whether it's a halting site. Nobody has the right to say, this is my patch and I don't want those sorts of people moving into my area. Like, that to me is totally unacceptable.
Okay. Moving on to the politics of this, you said you're going to be speaking to Minister O'Gorman in the next little while. Roisin Garvey, the Green Party senator, she said that Minister O'Gorman had been thrown under a bus with this issue. We are hearing persistent reports that there is at least some friction at cabinet level because Minister O'Gorman does seem to be dealing with all of this alone. Can you explain what's going on?
Yeah, I can. Well, Minister O'Gorman is the head of a very big department, a department which both he and the Green Party were keen to be established, and part of the responsibilities of that department, which involves children, disability, equality, youth, is integration. These matters would have formerly been run by the Department of Justice, but that was changed on the formation of this government.
Because the Green Party asked for that.
Yes, and we were happy to agree with that, that we would take some aspects of dealing with asylum and refugees out of justice and into this new department, which is essentially an equality-based department.
So you asked for it, Roderick. You got it.
No, I wouldn't say that. But what I am saying is that this is a major issue. There is a whole of government approach. What we do is coordinated by a cabinet committee on Ukraine and migration. I chair that cabinet committee as Taoiseach. My senior officials pull together the senior officials group, and every department has to do its thing. So the lead department when it comes to accommodating asylum seekers and people from Ukraine is the Department of Integration. The Department of Justice deals with the applications as to whether they should be granted refugee status or not. The Department of Education has done a fabulous job. You know, 15,000 Ukrainian kids in our schools now. The Department of Social Protection makes sure that people get PPS numbers and work permits. The Department of Health makes sure that people get medical cards and healthcare. So every department is doing its bit. And the particular role that the Department of Integration has on this is reception and integration.
So, and
accommodation.
Minister O'Gorman was asked yesterday if he feels supported, and he said he does, but all of us need to do more. All of us need to do more. That could be seen as a pointed comment from somebody who doesn't feel fully supported.
Look, it could certainly be portrayed that way, but I don't think that's what he meant. And like I say, I'd speak to him every week. We're also constituency colleagues, by the way, so we know each other well and personally. I'll be speaking to him again this evening. Certainly when Minister O'Gorman has asked for money, it's been brought forward. I think his department now has a budget of $5 billion a year. It's one of the biggest budgets now for any department. When he's asked for staff, he's got additional staff. But what's often happened is you can be allocated sanctioned for additional staff, but finding staff and finding people willing to do the work can be difficult. And then obviously he needs help with accommodation. There's actually a group, again, under my department, under the Department of Taoiseach, led by a former county manager in Limerick. And he's in charge of renovating all the old buildings. So, you know, there's a lot being done. For example, the Department of Defence and the Taoiseach at various points in time has made available defence facilities. So, you know.
And could the Department of Housing do more, the Minister for Housing do more here to help Roderick O'Gorman?
I don't think there's anybody under greater pressure to do things and fulfil their own programme responsibilities than the Minister for Housing. You know, we'll probably talk about the housing crisis a little bit later on. I think.
So he has enough on his plate.
Look, I think a lot of ministers are working really hard here, and there are no two ministers who have more on their plate now at the moment than Minister O'Gorman managing the migrant crisis. 100,000 people, unprecedented in our history, quite frankly. And then and then Mr. O'Brien dealing with the housing crisis. So I don't think it's a case of we should be, you know, I don't make any sort of sense that we all have. I think what Mr. Graham said is absolutely right, is we all need to do more and we all need to support each other.
Well, the Labour Party leader said that you should step up now and lead this, because it is such a crisis.
Yeah, well, you know, I am leading it.
Well, you're not, though. You said the Department of Integration is leading it.
No, the Department of Integration has a particular role, and the particular role that Department of Integration has is reception, integration and accommodation. The Department of Justice has the role of determining whether asylum seekers should be granted asylum or not. Department of Education provides schooling. Department of Health provides healthcare.
And you've gone through all of that.
And my department, the Department of Taoiseach, has a particular role in pulling it all together and coordinating it. And that's exactly what I'm doing. And I do that personally by chairing the Cabinet Subcommittee on Ukraine and Migration.
Going back to what you said about people who object at a local level, you've done that yourself, haven't you? You've objected back in 2017 to a housing development in your own constituency, and that just proves my point that politicians are playing two agendas here all of the time, the national agenda and the local agenda.
Yeah, I haven't objected to housing development in my constituency in 7 years.
But you have done it in the past.
I have, and I haven't done it in 7 years. And why haven't I done it in 7 years is because we're experiencing a housing crisis and I can't in clear conscience object to housing. Now, by the way, on that occasion, I didn't object to there being housing. I objected to the height of the particular building. But I don't even do that now because we are in a housing crisis.
Do you get asked to by constituents?
All the time. And I don't do it. And one thing that I find extraordinarily frustrating is, you know, opposition politicians standing up in the Dáil, giving out about the housing crisis, pointing the finger, being really sanctimonious, and then they toddle off to their constituencies and the first thing they do is object to housing.
And no one in Fine Gael does that. No one in Fine Gael does that.
Of course they do.
That's the nature of being a politician. I don't have to explain that to you. You've got to support the people who vote for you.
No, politicians make choices. And of course I support the people who vote for me. You know, I've been elected 4 times in my constituency, increased my vote on every occasion. But I make choices. And despite the fact that I haven't objected to any housing in my constituency in 7 years, I've still been re-elected. Pascal Donoghue, for example, does not object to housing in his constituency in Dublin Central. The Leader of the Opposition does, often because there might be one-bedroom apartments
and
there.
We'll talk to Mary Lou MacDonald about that when she's here. Now, moving on, you pitched this idea of a 30% tax rate. People might remember this. You asked the Minister for Finance at the time to have a look at it. It's in the hands of a Fianna Fáil Minister for Finance now. Is that something that in your remaining time as Taoiseach, in this term, that you want to implement?
My priority is to make sure that middle-income people pay less income tax. How that's done, I've never been particularly hung up on. And around this time last year, I asked Pascal Donoghue to look at it as an option. And the nature of politics is it was spun up in the media as my kind of personal idea that I was crusading about and pushing.
Well,
that was never actually the case.
We knew about it for a reason. I mean, you obviously wanted us to know about it.
Yeah, you knew about it because I was asked a question about it at I think it was a trade union meeting or something, or by a trade union activist, and I said it was
That doesn't matter how we know about it.
It actually does matter because it was portrayed in a way that was never the case.
Do you want to do it?
What I want is middle income people to pay less income tax. We've already gone to 40,000. You know, what's one of the achievements of this government and indeed my party in office is that you don't now pay the higher rate of income tax until you hit 40,000 and you only pay on the portion of your income above 40,000. And like, I don't like people on average incomes paying the highest rate of income tax. I don't like to see people losing half their pay increase or half their overtime in income tax. So whether we do it by increasing the band up from 40,000 to a higher figure or a middle rate, I'm actually not hung up on whether we do it, so long as we do it. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why my party agreed to participate in this government is because we got a commitment in the programme for government that we would index bands and credits to earnings. And that means another substantial income tax package in the forthcoming budget, which means middle income people, in fact, all workers, but particularly middle income people, will be able to keep more of the money they earn. And I'm absolutely open to how we achieve that. But I'm absolutely insistent that that programme for government commitment be honoured.
Yeah, but you have an income and expenditure problem, or at least one coming down the tracks. And we saw the Commission on Taxation and Welfare, their most recent report. Now, back at the time when that was leaked, I know that you said you compared it to something straight out of the Sinn Féin manifesto. Do you accept its recommendations overall, though, that revenues raised from taxation and pay-related social insurance, they will have to rise materially in order to pay for what we need to pay for?
Oh, I think the jury's still out on that, actually. And, you know, I'm around long enough to have seen a lot of these reports. I don't know the amount of times that I've seen reports projecting, for example, that the social insurance fund would go into deficit. And actually, it keeps going into surplus. And I don't know how many times I've seen reports, you know, almost suggesting that the amount of corporate tax that we receive is going to collapse next year. And of course, we know that's not the case. So I think the jury's out.
Do you think that the corporation tax levels will be sustained beyond the predictions for 2026?
The truth is nobody knows. Our current projections are that they will continue for a number of years. But that could change. You know, like I'm in government 12 years now. That brings you a lot of experience. When we started off in government, before I even got into government, when I was in opposition, for example, nobody predicted the financial crisis or the collapse and the crash that happened. After that, nobody predicted the fact that our economy would bounce back so quickly. Nobody predicted Brexit. Almost nobody did. Nobody predicted the pandemic and nobody predicted hyperinflation, or very few people did. So what I'm saying is that nobody can. You can guess.
But the Department of Finance says we're going to need by the end of the decade to spend an extra $7 billion a year on age-related costs. So it's not just reports coming from random people who you may or may not agree with. It's your own Department of Finance.
Oh, no. What is absolutely the case, and this has been true since probably the beginning of time, certainly since the foundation of the state, is that when you've a rising population and an ageing population, you have to spend more every year on pensions and healthcare. Like, that's pretty obvious. I don't think anyone could possibly dispute that. But whether you can afford to do it or not depends on the size of your economy. So if your economy continues to grow, if the number of people who are working continues to rise, if their incomes continue to rise, well, then more and more tax revenue comes in. So
that's what you're counting on. You don't think we need tax rises. You don't think we need property tax increases.
I think that all depends on the extent to which your economy grows, the number of people at work grows, and the amount they earn grows. So there, what I'm saying is there are a number of variables here. And to me, it's a statement of fact and obvious that if you've a rising, aging population, you're going to have to spend more on pensions and healthcare. Of course you are. But it's also a statement of fact that if you have more people at work every year, if your businesses are more successful every year, and if people earn more every year, well, then you're going to have the revenues to match it. And that's why it's so important to have pro-enterprise, pro-European, pro-trade, pro-growth policies. And the biggest risk, in my view, to our country's future is any fundamental change in those policies.
OK, so Michael D. Higgins was right then. We are obsessed with economic growth.
I don't think he said we were. I think he said economists are. I think economic growth is important. I think, as one economist, Seamus Coffey, said, you know, try not having economic growth for a few years and see what it looks like. And we only have to look north of the border or eastwards to the UK to see what that looks like.
The president's concerns were we're obsessed with economic growth at the expense of our climate and social responsibilities.
Yeah, I think we need to look at them all. I often hear the argument that people are obsessed by GDP, and I can absolutely guarantee I'm not anyway, and I don't think government is. But when I knock on doors and I talk to people, they are interested in employment. They want to know if there's going to be jobs for them and their kids. They are interested in things like incomes, for example, how much they'll earn, whether it'll allow them to afford to buy a home, that type of thing. Again, one thing when it comes to climate, what we really need to do, and this can be done, is not to see climate and the economy as a trade-off. You know, there are huge economic opportunities in embracing climate action. Like, one of the things that I believe in, and part of my vision for the future, is that Ireland should become energy independent. That instead of importing oil, gas and coal, we should produce our own electricity, develop new industries out of that, like green fertilizer, like sustainable aviation fuel, export that to other countries. Like, that's how you achieve climate action and deliver economic growth. Like, isn't that the kind of thing we should be debating and talking about? Not necessarily that we have to accept a smaller economy in order to do the right thing by the environment.
So just on what you were saying, you know, if growth continues and if corporation tax continues to come in at close to where it's at now, is saving what we have, that big pot of corporation tax, the rainy day fund that we've mm-hmm. been hearing about, is that the right thing to do? Should you not just spend it?
I think it's right to save some of it. I think some of it should be spent, quite frankly, on things like housing, for example, on things like climate action, on putting money back in people's pockets. You know, as your mother might have said, you don't have to save all your money and you don't have to spend it in one shop either. So I think we should set some of it aside as a precaution.
You're going to leave that there for Sinn Féin to spend, are you?
No. First of all, it's not. I don't like the idea of being called a rainy day fund, because, you know, every day, sadly, is a rainy day for somebody. Mm-hmm. So I think that describes it very poorly. The way I would see it is essentially a pension reserve fund. So putting aside funding for that period in the future, should it arise, and you've raised it, where perhaps the economy doesn't grow, and yet we still have these pension costs.
So have you
worked out, wouldn't
it
be a smart thing to do to have a pension fund set aside?
How much of it would you keep?
Yeah, so that has to be worked out. So two things have to be worked out between now, really, and budget day. One, how much do we set aside? And then, crucially importantly, is what do we do with it? Because you can do one of two things. You can set aside essentially like in an escrow account, you know, on deposit, or maybe invest very safely in bonds, or, you know, hold it overseas, mm-hmm. Or you can have a state pension fund and you might invest it smartly, for example. For example, you might invest it in renewable energy. So they're the two things.
So it's working for you.
But have you? Or you might do a mix of things.
Have you worked out a broad percentage of how much should be spent and how much should be saved?
I have options in my mind. Yeah. And of course, you know, some can be used for debt reduction and some can be used to put into an Ireland future fund or a pension reserve fund or an anti-austerity fund, whatever you choose, choose to call it, that has to be decided by government. So I'm going to avoid answering the trick question.
Listen,
this time, Claire.
Cost of living issues, I mean, it's such a broad category, but let's focus on your Minister of State, Neil Richmond. He made a fairly big song and dance, didn't he, about bringing the retail sector in for the forum and saying to us that he was going to get them to reduce their prices. But nothing happened. Nothing happened.
Well, I think we are seeing some prices come down. You know, petrol and
diesel. Not because Neil Richmond shook his finger at them.
No, I think, you know, we have a retail forum and it is the basis through which government engages with the retail sector. And generally speaking, it's a good relationship. It's an important industry, employs a lot of people. Mm-hmm. What I asked him to do was to bring forward the regular meeting of the retail forum, to sit down with retailers, to say that this was a serious issue that people had a real concern about, that we understood that when their input costs were going up, that they had to pass on some of those increases to their customers. But we're now in a position whereby input costs are coming down and it would appear they're making substantial profits. We're not the only one saying that. The European Central Bank is saying
that. But you can
say
that until the cows come home. You can't actually do anything about it.
Well, there are things that can be done. The CCPC, the Consumer and Competition Protection Commission,
but you can't do price caps. I mean, you've more or less said that's not going to work.
We don't think price caps are a good idea. The one thing we could do is a windfall tax, for example, on the profits of retailers.
But you don't know what the profits are. They don't tell us.
That's right, but there are mechanisms by which that can be dealt with. But we don't really want to go down any of those lines at the moment. You know, what we're saying to the retailers is that we understand that you have a business to run, that you have staff
but
to pay, you have to make a profit.
Please, can you make the prices a little lower? That's all. That's all you can do.
No, it's not that feeble. We're sending a very clear message to the retailers that the current inflation crisis is not an opportunity for greedflation. Mm-hmm. We understand that you have to put up your prices when your input costs go up. Everyone does.
Or else. Or else what? If they don't bring down the prices in 6 weeks, what happens?
Well, again, there are a number of options. There's a windfall tax on retailers.
On the profits that you don't know about.
Yeah, but there is, as with any company, there are ways of working out what their profits are. And we do know that some of the companies, others don't. It depends on their corporate structure. The CCPC also has the power to carry out investigations if there's any evidence of price fixing, of price signalling, of cartel-like behaviour.
Yeah, which, I mean, you're big enough to say, I can't bring down the prices charged in supermarkets. I can't do it.
No, but we can influence the environment under which these things happen, and that's what we're trying to do. When it comes to price caps, very clear advice from the Consumer Protection Commission that's not a good route to go down. Mm-hmm. And for example, attempts were made to do it in Spain. They abandoned it because of the impact it would have on small retailers, particularly in rural areas, and also not a huge amount of evidence in countries where they have done it that it's really worked. What you often end up sometimes is with the shortages.
But because you don't know what their profits are. None of us know what their profits are. They don't tell us. When they say that they're not profiteering, you have to just accept that, don't you? Because you don't know any different.
No, we don't just accept it. And there have been analyses done by different bodies, including the European Central Bank, which would indicate that the food industry, the energy sector and retailers have been taking considerable profits out of this situation. We are now proceeding towards a windfall tax on the energy companies. We'll have that enacted in the next few months, certainly by the end of the year. We'll collect it after September, and we'll use the money from that to help families, help small businesses with their energy costs. Mm-hmm. So a similar approach could be applied to the retail sector, but we'd rather not have to be in that space.
Why?
Because we'd prefer if they reduce their
prices.
Again,
that's back to asking them nicely to do it. You're saying we'd prefer not to do anything. You don't want to do anything, so they can just charge what they want unless they hear you and they respond to your gentle request to bring down the prices.
No, the message is very clear. You increased your prices when your input costs went up. Fair enough. Your input costs are coming down. We want to see you reduce your prices. Mm. If you don't, we have options. One option is a windfall tax. It's already going to be imposed on the energy sector. Another option is action being taken by the CCPC.
So does that mean then the electricity grant will be back in the winter?
We'll have to decide that. So again, that'll be a decision for budget day.
But would you like to see €200 back every 3 months over the winter period for people?
You know, that's going to depend on the extent to which electricity and gas prices fall. And we'll see how that transpires over the next couple of months.
Okay. Just on your own party, a number of your own TDs have already said they're not going to run in the next election. And some of them, they were the Young Turks who supported your leadership bid. Do you take that personally?
Oh, not at all. And, you know, thankfully I had the support of nearly 80% of my parliamentary party when I ran for leader. So inevitably, anytime anyone retires, there's a 4 in 5 chance that they voted for me for leader. That's just maths. I think what you're seeing, and other parties will have the same experience, between elections, a number of TDs will decide not to run again for various different reasons. Fine Gael is different from other parties in the sense that we have a lot of TDs who have a lot of long service. You know, most TDs only get elected once or twice and then they lose their seats. Because of our electoral success from the kind of 07 to 16 period, we have a huge number of TDs who have served 4, 5, 6, 7 terms. They're 20, 25 years in politics. They've been in government, they've been in opposition, they've been ministers, they've been backbenchers, and some of them want to go on to do other things. Mm-hmm. Some of them want to retire. I entirely respect that. What it does do is create opportunities for hardworking, ambitious councillors, hardworking, ambitious senators, and potentially even people outside of the party to run for the Dáil and get elected next time.
What's your seat target?
Our target is to increase our vote and increase our seats. So we'd like to get us into the mid-20s in terms of party support. And depending on the size of the next Dáil, we don't know that yet. That would have us in the ballpark of about 45 seats. If we can achieve that, then
that's only 10 more than than Fine Gael's worst election, which was the last time.
Yeah, it wasn't actually our worst election, either in terms of votes or seats, but that won't stop people in the media making that claim. But it wasn't a good election.
But in an expanded Dáil, 45 seats is a fairly low ambition, would you not say?
Well, like I say, we don't actually know yet what the size of the next Dáil is going to be. We'll know that around August. What I'm saying is that our ambition, after 3 terms in government, which is an extraordinary historic achievement for our party, we will be seeking a 4th term. And we can achieve a 4th term in government, I believe, if we can get our vote into the mid-20s. And that means roughly 45 seats. And then we obviously have to build a coalition from there. But bear in mind, there's no party in the Dáil at the moment that has 45 seats. So, you know, politics is much more fragmented than it used to be. 45 seats is more than any party in the Dáil has at the moment.
A lot of coverage over the last few days of the Instagram post that your partner, Matt, made when you were both at the coronation, King Charles's coronation. Are you embarrassed by that?
Look, Matt's apologised for it. I don't think he ever intended his private Instagram posts to be disclosed to the media or published in the media. But look, that's modern world.
Did you know, because obviously you were together on the day, did you notice him posting? And were you in the group that was receiving the messages?
Well, I didn't. No,
you didn't have your phone.
Not at the time, but I did
so
later.
So you followed the rules. You didn't have your phone with you at the coronation.
I had my phone with me, but I wasn't.
Okay, but you must have seen him taking pictures, did you not?
A bit like me, he's on his phone a lot. I wasn't monitoring who he's messaging or anything like that. Like, that's just.
Yeah. Do you think it was overblown, the reaction to it, the Telegraph, the Mail, the Spectator and so on?
Well, look, you know, these are just things that happen in life. You know, Matt felt it was appropriate to apologise. He has done so. The only thing I would say is this, you know, over the past 7 years, both as Taoiseach and Tánaiste, I've invested a lot of time in foreign policy. And we've had a lot of success. We've won a seat on the UN Security Council. I've been involved in negotiating all 3 agreements with the UK government, the backstop, the protocol and the Windsor framework to avoid a hard border between North and South, to make sure that Brexit didn't affect our economy. We're probably more influential at EU level than ever before. Like, look at all the people in the senior positions across the European structure. Our relationship with the US post the Biden visit has never been better. And we've also got this monkey off our back, this whole issue around corporate
tax. But look, Matt having the crack at the coronation risks a little bit of that goodwill.
Yeah, and look, I don't think it's any implications in terms of foreign policy. But look, I understand that in the real world of politics and media, sometimes people concentrate more on the little things than the bigger things.
Right.
And I remember Enda before, and you know, like, Enda did a fabulous job as Taoiseach, really restored our reputation internationally, got the Troika out. And you remember the hullabaloo about him looking at his phone when he met the Pope, or, you know, a metaphor about ATM machines, you know, and look, as Albert says, often it's the little things in politics.
But Fionnuala never had to apologise for making Instagram posts at a royal event. There you go. One more issue I want to ask you about. You are quoted today telling the child who was involved in that attack in Navan, which people will have heard about, that life does get better and not to give up. Now, when I read those comments this morning, I thought they were really personal and from the heart. Were they?
Yeah, I guess so. Look, I grew up in 1980s, 1990s Ireland. I had a great childhood, but Ultimately, I was the brown guy with the funny name who a lot of people suspected was gay. So would have some insight into maybe what it's like not to be the popular kid in school.
I just felt it was a really personal response, that there was a level of understanding there that was heartfelt.
Well, look, all I'd say is to the young man who was in that video, really feel for him. Shouldn't have been subjected to violence. Shouldn't have been humiliated by having that video posted online. It's a very sick kind of individual that posts pictures and videos with the purpose of humiliating other people. And also the bystanders, you know, nobody intervened to help him. And look, I can only imagine how he feels now. Very isolated, very alone, probably even embarrassed, maybe a bit ashamed. But I think for a lot of people who maybe had a hard time in school, life does get a lot better. You get to go to college, you get to spend time with people who are much more like you. And I just hope that he's supportive family, supportive parents, and
can see that person
can see that. Yeah.
And the social media companies, and we've had requests from the Gardaí not to share that video, and some people were sharing it, and they meant very well in sharing it. You know, they were condemning it. But social media companies have a role, do they not, in this?
They do. They have a very significant role to play in taking down this content very quickly and also cancelling the accounts of the kind of people who post and repost stuff like this. And one of the reasons why we're establishing an online regulator, an online safety commissioner, under this new commission, the man, being established by Mr. Catherine Martin, really radical, really progressive legislation that'll be up and running very, very soon and will strengthen the powers, because the era of self-regulation is over and the powers will be there and they'll be much stronger to require companies to take down content like this, to suspend accounts and also fines. Very significant fines can be imposed on those companies if they don't comply. But you know, I think often the social media can be scapegoated when it comes to issues like this. There's also the traditional media have responsibilities as well in this regard and are very quick to blame everything on social media, I think, sometimes, and don't take their responsibilities seriously enough. And also there's an issue of the parents involved here. You know, the parents of those kids involved in that attack know who their children are, and they've responsibility to deal with this too.
All right, Taoiseach, thank you very much for coming in. Taoiseach Leo Varadkar, we'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.